Welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. If you live in Hawaii and pay attention to GOP politics, you likely get two different narratives. One, yet another claim of new ideas to rebuild Hawaii's Republican Party. The other focuses on the inability of the President and Congress to get anything done. An informational third piece is the one you probably don't hear. It centers on the American Greatness Movement. If that's not ringing a bell, sit tight. Contributing editor Neil Milner joins us now with some of the key points in this edition of The Long View. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
So is this American Greatness Movement something different than America First?
Well, America First, if you think about America First, is what Trump sort of talks about a lot. It's different in the sense that it's more comprehensive, but it very much is a kind of idea gloss, intellectual gloss on the things that Trump talked about in the campaign and that got him a lot of support and also got him a lot of criticism from your standard conservative pundits. What this means really is that an emphasis on American sovereignty, both political and cultural sovereignty, it means American greatness emphasizes the need to limit immigration because immigration that's unfettered threatens the American character. It believes in free trade, but with the caveat that when free trade hurts American workers, you don't do it. It believes its foreign policy is very much saying back away and support only American interests. So it's very insurgent in the sense that it criticizes some of the standard conservative arguments and criticizes the people who were critical of the conservatives as well as the liberals, but particularly the conservatives that were critical of Trump.
So is it then the American Greatness Movement that led to the America First idea?
Oh, I don't think it's anything that simple because, first of all, Trump is not a person of ideas. He's a person of instincts, and he kind of picked up on these sorts of things. I think what was happening is two things. This kind of insurgent group of idea people, some of them are conservative academics, began to look at Trump as a candidate and began to say, you know what? He is not the best person in the world. In lots of ways, we don't like him. He doesn't have any kind of sense of decorum that we would prefer. But what he is believing should and what he is saying, they didn't say what he is believing, is not only attracting support, but is precisely the direction where the conservative movement should be moving, away from establishment ossified conservatism. The conservatism of Reagan, the conservatism of Goldwater has kind of run its course.
And that's exactly what they say in their statement.
In their Declaration of Independence. This is a group of people that were really writing anonymously during the Trump campaign. Not anymore, but they were.
And that's why we didn't hear very much about them during the campaign.
Well, you also didn't hear very much about him because the typical campaign tropes were about the election itself. They were about how Trump isn't going to win anyway, and what he's doing wrong, and the criticisms, the right-wing criticisms of Trump, whether they came from a kind of in a sort of unsystematic way from some of the Hawaii GOP people, but more important from very established and respected conservative intellectuals like David Brooks and Ross Douthat, they were getting the press because they had essentially the ear. So you didn't get this kind of insurgency, which is very different because most right-wing academics, we know this from surveys, can't stand one thing about the political right, and that is its increasing lack of decorum. So all of a sudden you had a very indecorous candidate who was believing in ideas that some of these people believed in, and so they went ahead and started pushing it.
So can there be a Trump-centric intellectual movement that can either embrace him or throw him away?
Well, they don't want to embrace him at all. I mean, essentially, their long-term goal is to
But they tag to him.
Well, they
I mean, it's expedient.
Well, it's expedient, but you have to be careful here. They're not interested. They claim we're nonpartisan. We're certainly conservative. We have long-term goals, and they understand that Trump has very limited the advantages that he brings to this movement were very obvious to them, but they're also very limited. So this is not going to be a movement that becomes attached to a president the way, say, the right became attached to Ronald Reagan or to a candidate like Barry Goldwater, who were clearly role models in all sorts of ways.
We talked about the American greatness statement a little earlier. I mean, just to be really clear, they say, quote, "We believe that American conservatism has lost its way, and as a result, it has lost much of its original appeal. The once vibrant political movement that nominated Barry Goldwater, elected Ronald Reagan, and defeated global communism has become ossified and unthinking to the point that conservative intellectuals act like priests, mediating unknowledgeable truth to the masses and administering the sacraments of conservative orthodoxy." That's a pretty academic statement.
Well, it is a pretty academic statement. That's one of the interesting things and also one of the dangers of it. You have to remember that there's been a lot of criticism of standard conservative politics, especially as Congress carries it out, from all different parts of conservatism. They differ over American greatness, but that's clearly been the case. All you have to do is look at health care, and you can see why the political right would say there's no there anymore. It's all rot, and you have those kind of things. It's academic language for sure, and that's one of the dangers, as far as I'm concerned, of this, because it seems to me that American greatness, and notice we haven't mentioned a name, Steve Bannon, who's not formally active in this movement but clearly supports a lot of this and has the president's ear. American greatness's emphasis on the American character and on a kind of common political religion that we have can be used as a kind of intellectual gloss for the kind of white resentment that clearly drove a lot of people to support Trump, including a lot of Republicans more, in quotes, like us. Than anything else. White resentment is clearly an important part of American politics. And one of the dangers here is that this becomes a kind of way to legitimate it. And from my standpoint, from my own political standpoint, that can be a danger.
Do we see any evidence of this in Hawaii within the GOP? Are they even aware and talking about this what we hear?
Here's the thing about Hawaii. First of all, it's different. And so playing out white resentment is very different here. We don't know. The second thing
but
is...
But we do hear about the America First, and we do hear all the tropes that we have been hearing
but
for months and months on end.
You don't hear much about it here. The other reason you don't hear much about it here is good ideas, bad ideas, threatening ideas, whatever. The Republican Party doesn't express them here. It's essentially a non-entity when it comes to a kind of political discourse. So I can say that we don't know what is going on here, and maybe it's on me to try to find out more, but there are certainly good reasons for it. You don't have any kind of tradition here of conservative ideas being expressed in the public. There are a few people that do it, Rick Hamada and a few others, but it's totally bereft here. So we're really not players in this at all. We certainly weren't players in the Trump election, and not just because this is a Democratic state, because the Republicans here didn't know what to do with Trump. First, they dismissed him as being too nasty for Republicans here, and then he won the primary.
But we are watching the factions of conservatism happen here. I mean, you've got the Republican Party, you have the Republican Assembly. How does that fit into any of what you may be seeing coming out of American greatness?
Well, it's the Republican Assembly, for people who don't know, is a kind of insurgent group that that gets treated by the Republican Party establishment here as just a bunch of troublemakers. Part of that is because they do make trouble. The other part of it is that it's hard to follow what the Republican Assembly thinks about in terms of these kinds of ideas. They certainly were more likely, people who are support the Republican Assembly were certainly more likely to be Trump supporters. But it's not at all clear. They've never really made a statement along the lines of American greatness along those lines.
So what do you take away from this as you mentioned, not really a part of our reality here in Hawaii, but as we look back over the ocean and look at the rest of the country, what's the lesson?
Well, the lesson is you should watch what's going to happen here, because I think that at the same time that I always tell people, you're way too Trump-centric. You spend way too much time watching the news and listening to the news from day to day as if that's going to explain what's going on in a broader sense in America. One of the things you have to pay attention to are the there is certainly in both parties are the, is the kind of fight for the soul of the party that's going on. And you can see that in the political right, with the Koch brothers trying to maintain their establishment, with these kinds of things developing, and with what the social conservatives are going to do, which we did not talk about here, and we could talk about it another time.
Oh, good. Time for another conversation when
sure.
you come back. Thanks very much, Neil.
Sure.
Neil Milner, excuse me, taught political science at UH Manoa for 40 years and is the contributing editor of our biweekly segment, The Long View.
Aloha, I'm Craig Jenkins, a storyteller from London, England. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. Coming up, celebrating the music of the tango, but first, your quiz.
In today's Backyard Quiz, we're thinking about a beloved healer who came to Hawaii in 1883 aboard the SS Mariposa at the head of a group of trained nurses from the Order of St. Francis. She came in response to a plea from King Kalakaua for help with the island's Hansen disease patients. Her team was charged with management of the Kaka'ako Branch Hospital on Oahu, which served as a receiving station for Hansen's disease patients from all over the islands. The most severe cases were shipped to the island of Molokai for confinement in the settlement at Kalawao and then later at Kalaupapa. In her response to the king's letter, she wrote, quote, "I am hungry for the work, and I wish with all my heart to be one of the chosen ones, whose privilege it will be to sacrifice themselves for the salvation of the souls of the poor islanders. I am not afraid of any disease." She gave her life to Hansen's disease patients, and in 2005 was named a saint by the Roman Catholic Church. Today we're looking for her name. You can call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689 if you know the answer. And the first one to get it right gets the Backyard Quiz tote bag that says, "You got it right."
Aloha, I'm Claire McFarlane. I'm running beaches around the world in support of survivors of sexual violence. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
The Argentinian composer Astor Piazzolla, a virtuoso of the bandoneon, has cast a long shadow. His legacy is a musical genre, Nuevo Tango, that merges musical styles to create a language all its own. Bandoneon virtuoso and composer J.P. Joffrey's Nuevo Tango Quartet includes classical violin master Eric Silberger. He and J.P. are in our studio, instruments in our hand, to give us an introduction to Nuevo Tango. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We're very excited to be here.
JP, I mentioned Astor because he's kind of the father of the style. Would you agree?
Yes, I agree with you, and I'm glad that you say that, because actually Astor Piazzolla is the, I would say, the only tango musician that really took the tango to the next level and brought it to the major concert halls. And nowadays, his music is performed for, by major symphony orchestras, major soloists. And I think as a bandoneon player, as a composer, we always feel in depth with Piazzolla because he brought the tango alive.
Sure.
Yeah.
Well, it was pretty much confined to Argentina, wasn't it, before he came out and kind of broke the went past the borders a little bit.
Yes, that's right. He actually couldn't even take taxis sometimes. Even the taxi players, the taxi drivers, they wouldn't pick him up because he was like the enemy of tango music. He was trying to change the music.
Yeah.
And in Argentina, you know, you can change politics, you can change religion, but you cannot change tango.
Yeah. Well, you know, like a lot of music masters had that happen to them, you know, where when they first started, they ran into a lot of resistance. That certainly happened with him.
Yes, that happens to every composer. You know, it's like it's very hard always to present the music and to, you know, to convince people this is something good that you're gonna like. You just have to open your mind,
yeah,
and enjoy it. You know, it's very hard all the time, but it's a challenge we have as all, you know, as composers. Well, that's what was my life about, so I enjoy it very much.
Sure. Eric, and you started, your training is in classical music. Mm-hmm. How did you come to Argentinian music?
Well, it's actually through the music of Astor Piazzolla. I've always really loved a lot of the music. I mean, I'm not sure if anyone recognizes, but Libre Tango.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of that music that there's just a certain sound I always was looking for, and that was the sound of the bandoneon, which is what JP plays.
Yeah.
And when I actually played a concert with him, I was the only person not an organist at this concert in the Alice Tully Hall in New York.
Uh-huh.
And afterwards, I bumped into JP, and he says, "Oh, I play bandoneon." And I said, "Oh, that's awesome. Can we do something together?" And then shortly after, we started working together, and ever since then, I've really enjoyed working with
him. Well, you brought one of your compositions. It's a duet for bandoneon and violin. And
yes.
It's a good opportunity for people to find out what this thing sounds like, right?
Great, great. In this opportunity, we'll play this piece that is actually is a bit far away from tango. It's a lullaby that has more to do, with, I would say, with modern music. But it's a lullaby I wrote to my niece. This is called Dulces Sueños, which means sweet dreams.
Great.
Thank you.
Beautiful, thank you. Those instruments blend really amazingly well, don't they? You make the violin sound like a wind instrument, and you make a bandoneon sound like a string instrument. Did I hear a kind of a movement from a very sort of dissonant harmony at the beginning to more consonant as the piece went on? It seemed that way to me.
Yeah, what you were playing. It's a very simple melody, actually in C major. That in order to to ornament it in sort of like a more modern way, I use some like very very tight chords.
Had some very close chord voicings underneath, and it kind of opened up more. Beautiful
and
piece.
The piece also is inspired a bit in the organ as well. You know, the bandoneon is actually a portable organ.
Portable organ, yeah.
Yeah, it was invented to play in the church, poor churches of Germany. That's why I do some like...
It's a great sound. Thanks so much for both of you for coming in. It's wonderful.
Thank you.
Very excited.
Very happy as Hawaii International Music Festival to present.
Yeah. Eric Silber, J.P. Joffre, and the J.P. Joffre Nuevo Tango Quartet will perform tomorrow evening at the Blue Note Hawaii in Waikiki. The group will perform at Kamehameha School's Heritage Center this Saturday and at Mark's Garage in downtown Honolulu Sunday at 5 p.m. as part of the Hawaii International Music Festival. Details can be found on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from the BIA New Summer Home Building and Remodeling Show, featuring new exhibitors and new seminars, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the Blaisdell, biahawaii.org.
Fighting words over North Korea's threats to the U.S. could increase the chances that Hawaii would be on the front line should a missile attack occur. Civil Beat Federal Issues reporter Kirsten Downey has today's reality check. Hi, Kirsten.
Aloha, Bethann.
We've heard a lot in the last day about fire and fury and very explicit threats on both sides, but that's been more couched around the idea of Guam being an attack site. Guam is halfway between Hawaii and the Philippines. How has Hawaii been in this conversation?
Well, the rhetoric between the United States and North Korea has certainly ratcheted it up. And the background to all this is that just last week, the UN Security Council imposed these tough new economic sanctions on North Korea, and this was done unanimously by the Security Council. And the idea was to sort of starve out North Korea's missile construction projects, which are advancing very quickly, and their capabilities are growing. North Korea responded angrily to the UN sanctions, and what we've seen now is this escalation in a war of words, with some people thinking this could be foreshadowing actual war, and some thinking this could be just tensions heightened and dropping now.
Because we don't really know which way that is, some would say that the better course would be to pretend as if it's real and make sure that there are our preparations, and we've had some conversations in past about that. But whether or not Hawaii would be the site of an attack is part of the conversation perhaps, but so is the part that would put Hawaii on the front line if in fact there are many military operations that might be coming from here. Is that also something that you're hearing a lot about as you talk to our congressional delegation and to others in Washington?
Well, there's no question that the threat from North Korea is not just theoretical anymore, that there's at least some risk of an actual attack that could happen here or elsewhere in Guam or on the American mainland. So there is real threat, real risk, and North Korean capabilities are growing. On the other hand, there is a real effort to try, international effort to sort of quiet things down. Okay, given that as what we see as the main news events, how does this affect Hawaii? Well, we are the home of the Pacific Command. So many of the military decisions that would deal with any kind of a war, whether it would be nuclear or conventional, would be planned and strategized here. Soldiers would be based here. And of course, we've been a major fulcrum for a number of wars that have been fought in throughout the Pacific, going back to the Spanish-American War, of course, World War II, where we suffered a direct attack, the Korean War, of course, Vietnam.
All true, but for a lot of people who say, okay, that's history, I'm concerned about me and my family, and here we are out in the Pacific. Is there someone who's looking after our best interest, and is our congressional delegation saying more or something other than just, you know, we need to bring down the conversation and to de-escalate some of these tensions?
The congressional delegation has been looking very closely at the explicit threat, and they put wording into the defense authorization bill last year requesting a specific study on the threat to Hawaii. They don't seem to think at this point that there is an explicit threat to Hawaii, I guess partially because there are a lot of other places that North Korea could hit now, but there's no question that Hawaii, as the home of the Pacific Command, will be at the center of any decision-making about what to do with North Korea.
So at this point, as there's not really a clear direction, in some cases some people would say there's not all that much of a clear direction in terms of what might be hit or what might not be hit, you still have a lot of people who are really concerned, and rightly so. Anything more coming from Hawaii in terms of what people should be doing or thinking about in ways that perhaps they haven't before?
Well, the governor is monitoring the situation very closely, as you might imagine, and the Hawaii Emergency Management Agency has put out some information about what you should do in the event of an attack. Here's the advice they've given: stay away from windows, try to stay inside until you're told there's an all clear, or 14 days, whichever comes first, and some recommendations along these lines, which I don't think many people find very comforting, but it's still useful information to know in the event of the worst occurring.
I think you're really right about the not comforting part. Kirsten, thanks a whole lot. We'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from civilbeat.org. Today with reporter Kirsten Downey. As people age, they often reframe the life behind them, sometimes bringing it more sharply into focus with deeper understanding, sometimes softening the edges with a rosy affection. In the soon-to-be-released film, The Glass Castle, we see both. In the film adaptation of Jeanette Wells' 2005 book, Maui-born director and screenwriter Destin Daniel Cretton shows the nuanced and varied perspectives of a family of four children who must take care of themselves. The parents' counterculture, free spirit, identities often endanger their kids, even as they try to teach them to find and rely on themselves. I spoke earlier today with Destin Daniel Cretton, and I asked him, what is it in this story that we might ask ourselves about the impact of parenting?
I really hope that this movie does what the book does, which is it doesn't really have any clear answers to that question, but I hope that it creates a discussion to allow people to talk about that and really think about the residue that they have left over from their parents, and also think about how much impact they have on the people who are under them, whether that's their kids or just other people who look up to them. That is something that I'm constantly doing. I'm constantly trying to be aware in my own life of things that I'm carrying from my past, and also being aware of how I could affect somebody else.
People are often very judgmental, especially when it comes to parents judging other parents. And the knee-jerk reaction when you first see the film is, how could a parent endanger a child like that? How could a parent not feed a child or allow a three-year-old to go off and try to make her own breakfast and then get burned in that way and seemingly take not very much responsibility for it or even understand that there was a role that they had to play in that? How do you think that syncs with parenting in general and how people judge each other?
It's a very interesting question, and I think in most cases it's easy to judge somebody that you don't fully know. It's much more difficult to judge somebody when you learn the context of everything that that is behind them and behind their actions. I mean, Jeanette has said something that's kind of stuck with me ever since the first time she said it, and somebody asked her if she has come to the point where she's able to forgive her parents for what they did to her. And she said for her, it's not about forgiveness because that makes her a victim. And the way she phrased it was, how can you forgive something for being damaged? And for her, it's less about forgiveness and more about acceptance. And that's not accepting necessarily things that they did and saying it's okay. It's just accepting them for who they are and the broken people that they are, and that there's freedom in just accepting that reality.
We often hear from psychologists who will tell kids who have been through harrowing situations that in part of accepting that, they also have to realize that their parents were doing the best that they could. It might not have been the best as maybe society might define it or as other parenting experts would want to have it, but that it was the best that those parents could do. That seems to be what you're saying about the place that Jeanette Walls has come in looking at her life and her parents.
Yeah, I think there's something really inspiring about where she has landed in terms of her perspective of her past. And she has come to realize that there's a good chance her dad had bipolar disorder. I mean, he was never diagnosed, but he had these extreme ups and downs and had a lot of the, he seemed, when she looks at her past, he seems to fit all of the criteria. And that combined with his alcoholism, that also combined with the upbringing that he had and the weight that he carried from his pretty terrible relationship with his mother in particular, I think she was able to see a perspective of her father that wasn't just a child looking at a dad. It has become a human looking at a human and seeing how much he has carried from his own past. And, I think in a way, Rex actually has gotten better. You know, as bad as he is, I think he has instilled things into his children that his mom never gave to him. Like, his mom never gave him encouragement or the belief that he could do anything in the world. And despite all of his, very real downsides, he did instill that belief in themselves to all of his kids and encourage them to just go after whatever they wanted to go after.
There also seems to be some lessons here for society at large. You mentioned that she looks back and believes now that her dad was bipolar. We talk a lot about mental health these days, more so than we ever have before, and yet it's still a very far length from the way in which we talk about physical health. Do you think that seeing this story and seeing some of both the upsides and certainly the deep down terrible sides of what happened in her childhood has made Jeanette's story one that is instructive for society?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot that we can learn from Jeanette's story. I think a lot of people still find the idea of mental health something that is, just out in the air somewhere that they can't grab hold of. But it is a very, it's a very real thing. And I do find it kind of dangerous to ignore that as a factor in terms of how people are acting towards each other. And when you look at her parents in the context of that, it is much easier to understand that they aren't necessarily operating from a place that we can, like, if you're a perfectly sane person, everything that they're doing just seems completely out of control and crazy. But there is something to definitely learn from her own analyzation of who her parents are. And I think more so than that, for people who are in that situation, for kids who feel that up and that daily and weekly up and down change of their parents, and it can be a very confusing thing. I think it's hopefully a story that can help people not feel so alone in that.
And is there also a message in there for the community at large in dealing with mental health? And what have you heard from the mental health community?
I mean, I think Jeanette, as she's gone around with this story and as she's been promoting this book, that has been a big topic of conversation. I don't really want to put words in her mouth because she's the one who really experienced all of this. But for you,
Dustin, as you were writing this and looking at this in a way that's now in a very different medium from the book and her story, but in a way that may be even more accessible to a lot of people if they go to the movies and they see this film, is this something that you think is going to help the mental health community make a couple of points about bipolar life with a parent and for kids and what the responsibility to society may be to families like that?
I mean, I hope it does. I really do. I hope it helps create discussion and gives people something to look at and have a reference point to create that type of dialogue.
Well, I want to thank you for the dialogue we had today, and I wish you all the best.
Thank you. Thanks very much for having me.
Director-screenwriter Destin Daniel Cretton was born and raised in Maui. He wrote and directed the 2013 film Short Term 12. Lionsgate is releasing his latest film, The Glass Castle, in theaters everywhere on Friday.
Aloha, this is Colin Moore, director of the UH Public Policy Center. You're tuned to Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
In today's backyard quiz, we remembered a woman who was beatified by Pope Benedict XVI in 2005, the 11th American to be so designated. She was a hospital administrator and member of the Order of St. Francis, who worked closely with Father Damien of Molokai, taking over his duties at Kalaupapa upon his death in 1889. The community she founded on Molokai continues to minister to Hansen's disease patients, and the Franciscan sisters continue to minister to parishioners throughout the Hawaiian Islands. Mother Marianne Cope died in 1918. 9 years later, Honolulu's St. Francis Hospital was founded in her memory as a community hospital and a facility to train nurses to work with Hansen's disease patients.
And we had a winner who knew exactly whose name we were looking for. Jody Gilbert called us from Kaneohe. I should say the phone lines lit up. Lots of you knew the answer to this one. Very good thing. That's today's quiz. If you've got one for us, you can always send it in to TalkBack at HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
All theater has its origins in the myths and legends of the deep, dark past, stories so old no one can remember where they came from. Operating on the idea that an understanding of myths and legends can deepen actors' immersion in their craft, the Honolulu Theater for Youth is offering a summer drama workshop that invites young actors to create their own primal stories. Lily Brennick is HTY's Assistant Director of Drama Education, and she's with us in our studio. Thanks, Lily, for coming in.
Thank you very much.
This is about myths and legends and other tales you create. That's the heading, right?
Yes.
What's the idea behind that?
The idea is that children get invested in their own stories.
Sure.
And being their own storytellers. And myths and legends are fun to play with because we don't know exactly what is true and what is not. Mm-hmm. So it lends itself to some creative freedom. And then the idea that the children can make up why something came to be or why, you know, they can be that storyteller, that arbiter of whatever, you know. They can be the new information makers.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Does that kind of sort of wild imagination come more easily to kids than adults?
I would not want to say adults do not live in that world, because I'm sure there are many that do, but but I do, yes, I think that's the fun. I mean, I have a 4-year-old who lives in making up stories, and mm-hmm. so I feel like they want to be storytellers. They want to tell stories and pretend. So, yes.
Because you kind of think of actors as vessels for somebody else's imagination.
Sure, absolutely. And HTY, I feel like what we find joy in is giving that back to the children, mm-hmm. letting them play there. They are the actors, but they're also the creators. And we want to hear what they have to say and what they have to create and what's inside their imaginations.
How do you lead them down that pathway?
Oh, it's we're going to look at myths and legends that exist that we know and sort of look at the structure of myths and legends. Mm-hmm. And we play a lot of various activities and theater games. And then we kind of deconstruct it in a fast sort of way to see the framework of a legend. Mm-hmm. And then ask them what would they like to know or what would they like to play in? What world would they like to sort of imagine deeper and further? What questions do they have?
What's an example of a legend and a framework for a legend that you might talk about?
I really like just as a very simplistic of, you know, what is something that we know around us? So example, like what is something you can see, right? We mm-hmm. can see, you know, we could see the stars, mm-hmm. right? And so let's imagine what was the world like before those stars were there, right? Mm-hmm. So then it's like, okay, it was just very dark. And so now there's stars. What was that middle moment that stars came to be? What was that one moment? So then we have them just kind of have that framework. Mm-hmm. There are stars, there weren't stars. And this one epic moment happened where stars appeared. And who were those people that did that? Mm-hmm. What were the circumstances around that? And then they slowly start to fill that out of, you know, making it more exciting and bigger and who the people were, what happened to make that happen.
Because there was a point in history when we just looked at those points of light in the sky and had no idea what they were.
Right, yeah.
Had to come up with something.
Sure, right? Exactly. And so why can't they make up why they think it's there? You mm-hmm. know, so I like playing in the what if, in the new, you know, in the new stories.
Mm-hmm.
So
you mentioned we were talking earlier about Kipling and his Just So stories.
Yes,
as things that fire kids' imagination.
Right, and that his stories are kind of similar. You know, there's like how the zebra got its stripes.
Yeah.
Right. The zebra didn't have stripes. An event happened, and mm-hmm. then now he does. Right. So it's kind of it's like that. And we will be looking at Just So stories to have students just sort of understand the story structure and how mm-hmm. stories are made, and then they can use that to inspire their own story making.
What ages are you looking
for at? This program is 7 to 11.
Oh boy!
Yeah, so
really
it's so that's second grade to fifth or sixth grade, mm-hmm. first or second grade to fifth or sixth grade. Yeah, and it starts. It starts this September.
That might be the time in childhood at which your imagination is arguably at its liveliest.
It's possible. Yeah, I would say so. Yes, absolutely. That's when they want to really tell you what they think might be and why it is, and you know, and they're willing to jump in and just give their ideas of what it is, mm-hmm. without hesitating, without questioning, without, you know, having to think too much about it.
Over the years that you've been teaching kids of this and other age groups, mm-hmm. have you seen changes in how they react to things like this? Is there some sort of a broader change happening?
I find when something is connected directly to them, their excitement level is higher. Mm-hmm. We Primary Players has been going on for 5 years.
Right.
So our last year we did create your own video game, mm-hmm. and they were super stoked about that because that's kind of in their world.
That's already part of
their world. Yeah. So I think students live in this world. You know, they go through the stories and they learn about how things are. And so I think this one will connect to them in that sort of way.
Mm-hmm.
The students we get, they want to play. You know, the children that are in our programs.
They wouldn't be there otherwise.
Right, yeah. They want to play. They want to act. They want to pretend. They want to find that joy.
Well, I'm sure they will.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot, Lily.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
Lily Brennick is the Assistant Director of Drama Education for the Honolulu Theater for Youth, whose Primary Players Saturday drama program this year is called Myths and Legends and Other Tales You Create. It will be offered every other Saturday starting September 9th, and you can learn more on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
As always, with activities going on throughout the state, we look to Morning Edition host Derek Malama for a look at events going on in our community that might have escaped some of us because they're a little bit under the radar. And Derek, people who are new to Hawaii can often find themselves sort of at a loss. They don't know how to pronounce any of the names of the streets.
Right. Well, there's this thing called the Newcomers Club of Honolulu. It's a social organization that welcomes new members to join. They have a lot of programs, apparently. Uh-huh. So you can learn more at Aloha Coffee Time tomorrow from 10 to 11:30 a.m. And to find out the location, you can email them at newcomersclubofhonolulu@yahoo.com.
I think that's a good idea for somebody. And a musical on Kauai is wrapping up its run this weekend.
Yes, the Hawaii Children's Theater's After Dark program stages Lucky Stiff, a musical comedy about a shoe salesman from England whose life changes when he learns that his uncle, who's a casino manager in Atlantic City, has been killed. Once again, this is a musical comedy, and all shows are at 7 p.m., starting tomorrow night through Sunday in the Puhi Theatrical Warehouse on Kauai.
And then on Maui, you can do yoga at the aquarium tomorrow.
Right. And this thing is called Aquari-Om, O-M, as in the chant.
Uh-huh.
And you can take your yoga to a new level of peace with nature at the Maui Ocean Center in Wailuku. And the class will be in the open ocean exhibit where you can see sharks, rays, and hundreds of fish. Bring a yoga mat and water. It starts at 5:30 tomorrow. There is a fee, and you can make reservations at the link on our website.
I picture these sharks lined up at the glass trying to figure out what these people are doing. Thanks very much, Derek.
You're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community going on under the radar. And you can always find out more about those events and others on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
I'm still thinking about the aquarium.
Yeah,
I think we may have to go check that one out. Meanwhile, that's going to do it for us for today. Up tomorrow, Hawaii's energy future. That's what we'll be talking about on Town Square. We hope you'll plan to join us.
And we'd like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave us your comments at this number, 808-792-8217. You also can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. Post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or BKOZHPR.
If you want to go back and hear something else that you missed today or you want to hear another show, you can find all of those on The Conversation page. There are links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. I'll see you tomorrow for Town Square.